This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Well, it's finally happened. Wall Street has completely lost touch with reality. All the major economic indicators are screaming recession. And what did traders do today? But going to have a big old party. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is the 28th of October. This one's a Tuesday, and it is good to have you with us for the latest on the financial crisis. Although, in the interests of full disclosure, we should mention that for today at least, Wall Street has completely forgotten that it's supposed to be repentant. We'll explain the details of today's 889-point rally on the Dow in just a little bit. But first, we're going to spend some time on the actual economy. You know, like how consumers are completely miserable and major American industries are lining up for government help. So you're a consumer, right? Maybe a little gun shy these days, not spending as much as you ordinarily might, holding a little tighter to your disposable income, are you? Yeah, I know exactly how you feel. And so do the folks who put out the monthly consumer confidence reports. The last time the numbers were anywhere near this bad was December 1974, as Marketplace's Steve Henn explains.
1974 wasn't the best year. Oil prices were up more than 230%, inflation was on a tear, unemployment was rising, and Barry Manilow released Mandy.
I remember all my life.
But as bad as that was, according to the Conference Bureau, Americans believe our economic future is even bleaker today.
You know, everybody's suffering.
From bank presidents to Mamadou Diallo, who says sales are down dramatically at a street corner jewelry stand in downtown Washington. Despite the bargains.
This is 10 also?
Yeah, I do play 8.
Okay.
Across the street, Zach Smith plays the sax for tips.
Well, people are stopping, but not as many as there used to be, you know.
He's staked out a metro station for 4 hours this morning and has less than $40 to show for it.
It ain't that people don't stop. It's just not quite as... A lot of people just don't have money to give. It's tight.
Around the corner, clerks at a lunch counter called the Daily Market say business is off 30%. Their customer, Karen White, is pulling back.
Especially for the holidays. I think it's a good, wise move to be kind of conservative right now.
But on this blustery fall day in Washington, Zach is still hoping to change the mood. But when consumers reach the top of the escalator and see the slate gray sky, they know it ain't summertime. And the living ain't easy. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
One more data point now to throw into the consumer confidence mix, as if you really needed one. A key measure of the housing industry out today, the S&P Case-Shiller Index, showed another huge drop in home prices. Speaking of huge drops, let's move on to the auto industry, shall we? Chrysler and General Motors have been in on-again, off-again negotiations about a possible merger for a while now. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports GM wants some government help to make that happen.
General Motors is hemorrhaging cash, and its credit rating is in junk bond territory. Chrysler's not doing much better. Getting together might help them weather the economic slowdown and the credit crunch. The merged company could downsize its workforce, close auto plants, and develop new vehicles. But GM needs an investment of about $10 billion in equity or loans to make a merger work. David Cole of the Center for Automotive Research says the automaker's failure would spiral into hundreds of thousands of job losses from assembly plants and parts suppliers to dealerships.
I think fundamentally now the government realizes what the potential cost of a failure would be, and what they're working on is how do you create a mechanism to provide this kind of support for the industry to get to the other side of this very fast, difficult river that they're in.
Most likely, the plan would include $5 billion now targeted to fuel-efficient vehicles and another $5 billion from the financial bailout. GM and Chrysler qualify as financial firms because they make auto loans. There is a lot of skepticism that a bailout will do much good in the long run. Gary Chasen teaches industrial relations at Clark University.
I think the companies made several mistakes in the past in terms of not quite clearly understanding what consumers wanted. And now they're paying the price for that, and I think they're looking for a bailout to help them stay afloat for a while longer.
Chasen says this isn't really a financial crisis or even a cost of labor crisis. The automaker's challenge, he says, is to develop vehicles that customers actually want to buy. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Even not counting layoffs in Detroit, hundreds of thousands of people have lost their jobs this year. And more pink slips are probably coming. That's lousy news for a lot of us, and for the economy, too. But it's actually good news for some employers, because companies with a little extra cash are finding this an excellent time to recruit new talent. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
It's poaching season for companies with cash. Neil Sims is a managing director for Boyden Global Executive Search. He says most businesses are holding off hiring, but for companies that can afford it, top talent is ripe for the picking.
Well, that always happens in a softer economic cycle. Companies with the opportunity to hire better people, stronger people, more experienced people will do that because those people become available when they would otherwise not be.
Big opportunities are being created for the little guys, says John Challenger, CEO of global outplacement firm Challenger Gray and Christmas. He says consulting firms, retailers, tech companies, and smaller financial firms are snapping up workers. Many are coming from Wall Street, which is expected to shed 45,000 jobs next year.
Smaller, medium-sized companies, or very successful companies that are riding out the storm, are taking advantage of this time to bring in top talent.
And there may not be much companies can do to keep their best people from being picked off. Wall Street, for instance, handed out more than $30 billion in bonuses last year, but the bailout package has put pressure on financial firms to rein in executive compensation. And executive search expert Neil Sims says bonuses are key.
Programs that augment an individual's salary based on their performance have become a very, very important part of compensation packages for executives today.
J.P. Morgan is suing a New York recruitment agency for trying to lure its executives away. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Crisis? What crisis? Traders blew the lid off Wall Street today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. A week from today, it's all over. No more debates, no more campaign ads, no more nothing, because the only thing left will be the voting. Unless you're one of the Republican or Democratic faithful looking for a job. The young people Barack Obama has made a point of reaching out to or reaching back to him with resumes in hand, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
It's a chilly October evening in Washington. A perfect night for cool jazz at a downtown Obama fundraiser. Young, starry-eyed Obama supporters dream of their perfect job in an Obama administration.
If they had a manager of entertainment, that would be fun. Hey, hosting the White House parties and, you know, that kind of stuff.
I would want to work in some kind of foreign affairs committee and try to improve our relations with countries like China.
That was Georgetown University student Russ Ballard. Before him, you heard from Millie Lee.
They're both young and enthusiastic, but unfortunately somewhat clueless. If Obama is elected, they'll be at the back of a very long line of job seekers.
They're stacked up like aircraft over O'Hare.
Paul Light teaches government management at New York University. He says Obama fans need to have at least volunteered for the campaign, but that's no guarantee of a job. Your resume has to get into the hands of a well-connected high flyer.
It's really a political process in which your connections matter most.
That doesn't sit right with Teddy Keenam Miller. The recent law school graduate owes about $100,000 in student loans. No matter, Miller is working for the Obama campaign in Florida for free. He stresses the election isn't over and says his main goal right now is getting Obama elected.
They've always taught us in graduate school about the importance of networking, but I guess I have kind of a distaste for the angling aspect of it.
Robert Shapiro says Miller will never get anywhere with that attitude. Shapiro was Bill Clinton's chief economic advisor during Clinton's first presidential run. He became Undersecretary of Commerce in the second Clinton administration after Clinton called and offered him the job. Shapiro says in a first administration, presidents are so overwhelmed they rely on advisors for hiring recommendations. Only the fiercest job anglers get attention, and Shapiro didn't want to swim with them.
Yes, they're certainly sharks. I'm afraid I was a porpoise. And I was eaten by the sharks initially.
Some people expect President Obama would hire more porpoises, less aggressive professionals. They think he'd break with sharks, like lobbyists and former White House staffers. But Paul Light says no dice.
You draw on people who are inside the Washington, D.C. beltway. A significant majority of the Obama appointees will have served in the Clinton administration.
What about rich sharks? Would Obama be less beholden to them because he collected a lot of small donations? Paul Light says no. Obama would pay special attention to wealthy donors. But Shapiro says they wouldn't get the top White House jobs.
You know, look, fundraisers have traditionally gotten certain ambassadorial positions. Who cares? Frankly.
Shapiro says Obama has so many donors, the impact of individuals is diluted, even if they're sharks. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Listen, here's what I think we ought to do. Only open the markets from 3 to 4 Eastern time. Once again today, the last hour was decisive. The Dow Industrials picked up almost 700 points in the final 60 minutes of trading today. We used to be able to end this broadcast by saying the Dow was up or down 0.5% or maybe a whole percent on an especially crazy day. In fact, every day this month but two, the Dow has seen triple-digit moves up or down. And investor jitters aren't the only reason for what the experts like to call volatility. From New York, Ashley Miltite has today's installment of our explainer series, The Marketplace Decoder.
Let's go to another kind of market.
Here we go! Bit of chalk quality here now.
Back in my hometown of London, purveyors of fruit and veg do everything they can to outshout each other as they fight for customers. That keeps prices low. Art Hogan is chief market analyst at Jefferies & Company. He says, say you went to a local market and wanted to buy apples.
If you have, 25 or 30 farmers standing there, the price is going to be in a pretty tight range because there's going to be a lot of offerings and there's competition.
He's talking about trading volume, the number of apples that are bought and sold. Reduce the number of farmers by half, he says, and there'll be a far narrower range of apple prices, which means customers are less likely to get a good deal.
That's exactly what happens in the stock market. The more participants you have, the higher the volume is, the less volatility you have. And the fewer participants you have, the fewer buyers and sellers that would minimize changes in price, the more volatility you're going to have.
The stock market's volatile now because loads of investors have pulled out, so there are far fewer shares to trade and fewer people to buy or sell. So when trades do happen, they can cause much bigger moves in stock prices than usual. Trader Mike McCarthy knows what that feels like. He says on a normal day, he can buy or sell 100,000 shares of a particular stock in a tight range.
Down a dime, down 15 cents or something like that. And now in this more volatile time, you'll get that same order, sell 100,000 shares of something, and you'll find yourself knocking the stock down, you know, a dollar or two.
It goes the other way, too, and just as dramatically. Just look at what happened today. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Coming up, pixies, sprites, and fairies, they're all the rage in the world of little girls.
I have a couple fairy books at home, and I read one, and I like how they're kind of creative, how they make clothes out of their own plants and stuff.
But first, let's do the numbers. Whiplash, anybody? The market's scorched higher today in a volatile session. The Dow Industrials powered up 10.8%, 889 points. Closed at 9,065. The Nasdaq jumped 9.5%, 143 points, finished at 1,649. The S&P 500 shot up 10.75%, 91 points, ended the day at 940. Go figure all that out. Financial companies racked up double-digit gains as buyers piled into the market. Bank of America bounced 12%. Wells Fargo galloped up more than 11%. Citigroup cranked up 14% today. Airlines took off, too. Continental lifted 12%, U.S. Airways soared 19%, UAL cruised 11% higher today. Walmart rang up an 11% gain on news of some cost-cutting measures. Bonds fell, the yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.83%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about business at Gather.com. What's the connection between champagne and collateralized debt obligations? Head on over to our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos uncorking the basics of the financial crisis.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Wednesday. The Federal Open Market Committee decides whether to cut the interest rates or leave them unchanged. President Bush meets with the Prime Minister of the Czech Republic in the Oval Office. And Democratic candidate Barack Obama will appear on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, less than a week before ballots are cast for president. I'm Allison Gilbert.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. So, let's see. Minus today's bump, the major indices are down, what, 35 or 40% so far this year? Wall Street, as we know it, is changing almost every single day. Jobs are being lost. Profits are disappearing. Congress is promising a new wave of regulation. So, do you think the securities industry could have picked a worse time to throw its annual shindig? Marketplace's Amy Scott checked out the party.
Just to give you an idea how things have changed on Wall Street, last year, Hootie and the Blowfish played the annual industry meeting. It was 3 days in Boca Raton. This year, the Harlem Boys and Girls Choir is on the ticket at a scaled-back conference in rainy New York.
A change has come over me.
It's one day, it's very focused, and I think it's reflective of the seriousness of today's situation.
That's Tim Ryan, president of the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association. It's Wall Street's main trade group. Ryan took the helm at the beginning of this year. Then he watched the industry unravel.
It's hard. I mean, it's hard to go to board meetings where you have very interesting, competent people who are not there 2 weeks later because their firm has disappeared.
It may be hard to feel too sorry for an industry that took so many risks, only to be rescued with taxpayer money. But today, some leaders accepted responsibility for the crisis. Blythe Masters has been called the woman who built financial weapons of mass destruction. She helped create complex credit derivatives at J.P. Morgan. In a speech today, Masters said Wall Street needs to rebuild its reputation.
The first step is to acknowledge accountability. Financial engineering was taken to a level of complexity that was unsustainable, and the players were not well regulated. We can help to correct that, and indeed we must.
The meeting wasn't all doom and gloom. Mike Gardner is with Wedbush Morgan Securities in Los Angeles. It's one of the largest independent brokerages left standing. Gardner says Wedbush steered clear of leverage and subprime loans. As a result, the firm is hiring.
We believe that there's going to be opportunities to add people where they've been dislocated because of the financial crisis.
Joe Sullivan is trying to place some of those people. He runs a financial recruiting firm. He admits business is tough. Paralyzed with fear is how he put it. But he says the industry is resilient.
You know, it's a big family here in a way. Everybody's sharing the same pains. So we're just trying to rally everything up.
Today's stock market rally didn't hurt. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
As we dig into letters this week, let's get back to a concept Mitchell Hartman brought us up at the top of today's broadcast, companies being too big to fail. Mitchell was talking about automakers, granted, but we started hearing about that idea a couple of months ago when banks and insurance companies were going under. Bailout money is finally making its way into the economy this week, and some of the banks that are left are using that cash to get bigger, to buy up smaller and weaker competitors. Last Tuesday, commentator Robert Reich said too big to fail really means just too big. Patrick Sewell from Birmingham, Alabama, says he welcomes that dose of common sense.
It's completely unreasonable to think that even larger banks will be able to withstand future crises. WaMu was the largest bank failure ever. Why would we think that even larger banks could magically become immune to failure?
My interview with Representative Henry Waxman, chairman of the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, drew some comments. I asked him about corporate culpability in the financial crisis and what new regulations that Congress is going to come up with might eventually look like. But David Rigby and many others of you thought I should have asked him something else, too.
Too bad Marketplace missed a great opportunity to ask Congress, including Mr. Waxman, how much of the blame should be pointed directly at Congress. Dating back to the 1990s, both parties have done a poor job of regulation and oversight.
On that point about regulation, at the end of the interview, Congressman Waxman called for smart rules to protect investors. Jim Ray of Goshen, Indiana said, nuh-uh.
I would argue that if we swing back to intense regulation, it would stifle our economy and be a generally negative trend. It will train our nation not to think for themselves, but to trust the government for everything. That's a bad place to be.
And on a lighter topic, Google's plan to take over the world. We had Kevin Pereira from G4 Television on with a new Google phone a couple of days ago. We talked about all that phone stuff, of course, and then Kevin pointed out his favorite feature.
Hold that to the mic. And okay. You'll see it's a nice screen filled with some fur. And go ahead and give your phone a little pet. Go ahead and just give it a little pet.
Oh, this is freaky. It's actually buzzing in my hands. Kind of goofy, I thought, but Heather McFarlane of Sacramento, California, thought it was a brilliant shout-out to Star Trek.
Google has created the electronic version of a tribble, a furry little animal in the second year of the show that emitted a relaxing trill that the Enterprise crew couldn't get enough of. The folks at Google are obviously hoping that, like the tribble, the G1 will reproduce itself exponentially.
If you've got a comment about our coverage or a memory about an old TV show, go to our website, it's marketplace.org, and click on that link that says contact. For years, Tinkerbell has done all the dirty work, flitting around in the background, quietly sprinkling pixie dust, while Peter Pan gets all the glory. But no more. Today, Tinkerbell moves to center stage as Disney releases the first of four new Tink movies on DVD. The newly empowered Tink is the cornerstone of what Disney hopes will be its next multi-billion dollar franchise, as Marketplace's Rachel Dornhelm reports.
Disney knows something about creating franchises for young girls. Its Princess line brings in $4 billion a year on sales of everything from Sleeping Beauty pajamas to Cinderella's glass slippers. But little girls like 9-year-old Bennett Flemingwood can age out of that obsession quickly. Bennett says she used to like princesses. Now they seem babyish.
They weren't doing things for themselves. Other people were doing it for them. Like Snow White, she wasn't as smart. You don't take food from strangers.
But fairies.
They're in nature, and you don't have to be like watching a movie or like wear a fancy dress. They can be more personality and smart.
Sitting next to Bennett for an impromptu focus group is 7-year-old Fiona McLaughlin.
I have a couple fairy books at home, and I read one, and I like how they're kind of creative, how they make clothes out of their own plants and stuff.
Disney picked up on this age group's affinity for fairies a few years ago. As fortune would have it, the company had a go-to heroine.
You know her name.
Tinkerbell!
For the past 3 years, Disney's been setting the stage for a whole new world of fairies. Today's DVD release will be followed by 3 more fairy movies. Tink is getting more FaceTime at the theme parks. And there's a new online site where girls, like the ones I talk to, can create their very own sprite.
So you can pick one of those that she doesn't already have. And she doesn't have an inklet.
Kathy Franklin is vice president of Global Studio Franchise Development at Disney. She says over 7 million personalized fairies are already playing together on pixiehollow.com.
What we found is most compelling for these girls about Disney fairies is that Tinkerbell has friends, and she's figuring out who she is and what her talent is and what her place in the world is. And that's something that 5-, 6-, 7-, 8-year-old girls are going through themselves.
Until now, Disney's been short of characters aimed directly at this age group, says Janet Oak, a marketing consultant at Just Kid Inc. And it's not a demographic the company wants to overlook.
In terms of sort of that age specifically, what you'll see is that they start to gain more and more influence with their parents over what their parents spend.
These little big girls already account for $3 billion a year in doll sales. And if Tink takes off, there will be a bigger licensing market for toys and other merchandise based on her, like friendship bracelets and fairy backpacks. Oak says 5- to 8-year-old girls can be a difficult market to reach.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole bunch of buzz about this sort of KGOY, they call it, kids growing older, younger.
That means dolls like Barbie and Bratz that were originally aimed at this group are now popular among younger girls. And 5- to 8-year-olds are tuning into tween queen franchises like Disney's Hannah Montana. Oak says Disney would probably be very happy if more of those girls adopted fairies and stopped making their teenage franchises uncool for anyone over the age of 8. Oak says parents might be happier, too.
For moms, I think it works on 2 levels. One, it maintains a sense of childhood innocence, and also taps into this idea of allowing children to find their special talent and what they're good at.
Your talent makes you who you are. You should be proud of it.
Disney has to be proud of its talent, turning pixie dust into gold. This year, amidst an economic downturn, the Fairies franchise is expected to bring in $1 billion. I'm Rachel Dornhelm for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $8 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, the latest milestone in the way the internet is changing the way we get our news. The Christian Science Monitor announced today it's giving up its print edition. The Monitor has been publishing on paper every weekday for 100 years. As of next April, though, it's going to be web only. The Monitor is something of an outlier as newspaper business models go. It's a nonprofit, first of all, funded by a church, but it does have 7 Pulitzer Prizes to its name. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow shot up 889 points, 10 8/10%. The NASDAQ rose 143 points, 9.5%. The S&P 500 jumped 91 points. That's 10.75% there. Hang on to your hats tomorrow, everybody. There's much anticipation of a rate cut from the Federal Reserve. Thanks today to Jennifer Collins, Renita Jablonski, and Doug Krisner on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Coming up next time on this program, as the economy falters, private equity goes in for the kill.
A private equity firm
could get so much debt so inexpensively that it could buy bigger companies than it ever could before.
I'm Kai Ryssdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.